I'm Matthew Smith for the Badcast, and I want to ask the question, can a scientist become a psychic and win $1 million? Now, I imagine the answer that most sceptics will give to that, and in fact probably many listeners to this podcast, is no. They'd probably suggest that psychic powers don't exist, nobody can be psychic, and therefore it's not possible to learn to become psychic. Well, I've always been fascinated by these questions as a psychologist and as a parapsychologist, and I'm hoping to find some answers as part of a unique and ambitious project I'm attempting over the coming year. Now, as I say, I'm a psychologist. I don't think I'm psychic, but I am curious about the possibility that maybe some people are, and maybe it is possible to learn to develop this stuff. Now, after nearly 20 years of researching apparently paranormal experiences from a strictly scientific perspective, I now want to see if I can actually discover and develop my own hidden abilities. And that's, of course, assuming that such things exist. I'm actually quite naturally sceptical about some of the claims, and many of the claims made by psychics, but I'm also aware there's some research out there, conducted by parapsychologists, which maybe suggests there's something interesting to explore. And also, there are one or two big-name psychics that make me just sit up and think, well, maybe there's actually something worth exploring here. So over the next year, I want to find out if I can develop my own abilities. And I would love to know what it feels like to maybe hear voices in the way that mediums say that they hear spirits talking to them. Or if it's possible to move objects or influence machines simply with the power of the mind, if that's at all possible, I would love to be able to do it. I read stories of remote viewers, people who can sit in one room and essentially describe events on a location that could be on the other side of town, it could be in another country. Again, you know, I'm reading these kinds of stories with a degree of scepticism, but there's always a part of me thinking, well, I wonder if this stuff is for real, and I wonder if somebody like me could learn to do it. You know, are they all just fantasies, or is any of it actually possible? Well, in an attempt to find out, I'm going to spend about a year of my life seeing if I can develop my own abilities. So as my very own test subject, I'll attend things like courses, workshops, read all the books that I can read, speak to psychics and mediums, get tuition and guidance from as many of the leading figures in the psychic world as I can. And I want to explore firsthand the world of clairvoyance, mediums, psychics, see if I can learn to read palms, read minds, read auras, whatever else they want to try and teach me. I'm open to seeing if I can actually learn to do this kind of stuff. I mean, on the flip side, I also want to know how much information we can give away without us realising it. And this is where my background in psychology hopefully will help. I want to find out maybe, do psychics simply become very, very proficient at cold reading? And this really describes ways in which you give the information to somebody who comes for a reading, and it's all to do with how they interpret it. There's nothing psychic going on, it's just something about the way in which these kind of interpersonal interactions take place. So, you know, we want to learn about cold reading. At the end of the year, I plan to put myself forward for the $1 million challenge that's offered by the James Randi Educational Foundation that's based in Florida. Now, James Randi is a professional magician, or was a professional magician. If anything, he's a professional skeptic. He's probably the world's best-known skeptic. And for a number of years, he has offered $1 million for anybody who claims to be able to demonstrate genuine paranormal abilities. And he will say, well, the money's still sat in a bank, no one has ever been able to claim it. Doesn't that suggest to you that maybe there is nobody out there with genuine abilities at all? And that's quite possible. But I'm intrigued by the possibility that maybe he's wrong. Maybe there is something to this. And what if someone like me could actually learn to develop their own abilities and win that $1 million challenge? So I'm really at the start of this journey. I want to find out as much as I can about psychics. I want to, obviously, going to write about my experiences. And in fact, you can read my blog at spiritualjunkie.co.uk. And from time to time, I'll note down there my experiences and how things develop. And maybe, in a year's time, I'll be able to do another podcast, and that time I'll be doing it from my new home in Barbados. Thanks for listening. This has been Matthew Smith for the Badcast.
The new 5-part Channel 4 Science series, The Genius of Britain, is available to own for the first time on DVD from the 7th of June. From the steam engine, evolution, the atom, the computer and the World Wide Web, British science has quite literally changed the modern world. Some of Britain's leading scientific names, Stephen Hawking, Richard Dawkins, James Dyson, David Attenborough, Robert Winston, Paul Nurse, Jamal Khalili, Kathy Sykes and Olivia Judson, will be telling the stories of the people behind these innovations. And to celebrate this release, we have 2 copies of the DVD to give away to our listeners. To win a copy, all you have to do is answer this easy question. Where was Richard Dawkins born? There, I told you it was easy. To enter, go to www.badcast.co.uk. Competition ends on June 9th. Any entries received after that date will not count. All terms and conditions can be found on www.badcast.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Alison Campbell from Waikato University in New Zealand. I write the bio blog primarily for biology students studying for senior school exams, but from time to time I take pot shots at bad science and at bad science reporting. I thought I'd talk this time about a press release that came out a couple of years ago entitled "Luxury Cars Really Do Get Pulses Racing." It purports to show that clinical studies prove that women find the sound of fast cars, and by extension the men driving them, very exciting. That'll probably push up the sale of luxury cars. But I had to ask, does this study really show what's claimed for it? Well, let's take a look at what was done in this scientific study. A group of 40 volunteers, 20 men and 20 women, listened to recordings of the sounds of various cars. Here's the article describing what happened. Participants of the clinical study were exposed to a recording of various supercar engines being revved. They listened to the roaring engines of a Maserati, a Lamborghini, and a Ferrari, and they were also exposed to a recording of a Volkswagen Polo to ensure a fair comparison of arousal was measured with an everyday vehicle. What happened next? 20 minutes after hearing each recording, the experimenters apparently measured the levels of testosterone, both sexes do produce this hormone, in the volunteers' saliva, comparing these samples with others taken before the experiment. What did they find? Here's what it says in the release. Quote, "The Maserati had the biggest impact on women, with 100% of the female participants showing a significant increase in testosterone secretion. 100% of female participants showed a decrease in testosterone in reaction to the Polo. 50% of male participants showed an increase in testosterone in reaction to the Maserati, and 60% of male participants showed an increase in testosterone in reaction to the Lamborghini. You better get rid of the V-dub Polo, guys." But hang on a minute, there's not actually a lot of detail here. Was the trial blinded? Ideally, the volunteers should not have known in advance which car they were listening to. Even better, was it double-blinded? That is, the people testing the saliva samples should have been unaware of which person and treatment they came from. Alas, we don't know, because that level of detail isn't provided. Nonetheless, the psychologist who carried out the study was very definite that the findings were real. Quote, "Testosterone is indicative of positive arousal in the human body, so we can confidently conclude from the results out today that the roar of a luxury car engine actually does cause a primeval physiological response." Maybe. But were people actually asked how they felt about the sounds? It's a fairly obvious question, surely, since responses to sounds can be quite subjective. I mean, I find the throaty roar of a souped-up engine more than a tad objectionable, especially when it's at full revs. It may well raise my salivary testosterone levels, but does this reflect a whoa response, or a desire to go and shove something up the exhaust pipe? After all, testosterone is linked to arousal, but also to aggression. So, science shows that girls are turned on by Maseratis, and maybe their drivers? Pseudoscience? Yeah, I think so.
This is forum member Catherine reporting for the Badcast. This week you'll be hearing from me about conspiracy theories, that ugly thing called denial, and why otherwise smart people believe dumb things. Now I want to start by saying that contrary to popular opinion, I have some smarts about me. I don't tend to wear my brain on my sleeve, however, nor do I poke people in the eye with it. Now in spite of my modicum of intelligence, I have believed some dumb and downright wackadoodle woo-woo in my time. Similarly, my former partner, a very bright man, had more than a passing interest in David Icke. David tickled him, you see. Not in that way, but more than one of Mr. Icke's books graced our communal bookshelf. David is well known and ridiculed as the poster child for bizarre conspiracy theories. His various claims include that human beings are the result of a breeding program conducted by a race of reptilians called Anunnaki from the planet Draco, and further that humanity is controlled by a network of secret societies. Icke calls them the Babylonian Brotherhood. The House of Windsor is part of the bloodline of the Brotherhood, and apparently Prince Charles is a shape-shifting lizard. As to whether Camilla herself actually shapeshifts, I'm unsure. Surely the fact that no sane shape-shifting reptile would willingly choose the physical characteristics of the prince's current facade is one of the strongest arguments against this claim. Anywho, given my partner's fascination with David, I was compelled to attend a lecture delivered by the man himself during a visit to New Zealand some years back. As I sat, slunk down low in my seat, hand discreetly shielding my face, I took in various diagrams and explanations about the shadowy dealings of the New World Order, and I remember peeking around the room at the assortment of freaks and geeks and wondering, who are these people that believe this guff? Some of them may have been there for comedy value, all because they were painfully alternative and quirky, but more than one had the look of reverent awe and belief as they took in David's words. Now, whether it's David Icke, Freemasons, or the question of did we really land on the moon, which incidentally I had to live through too, the fact remains that otherwise smart people believe dumb things. Dr. Michael Shermer, who has spoken and written extensively on the subject of why people believe weird things, suggests there are four factors that contribute to the genesis and ongoing belief in conspiracy theories, namely, patternicity, or a tendency to find meaningful patterns in random noise, agenticity, the bent to believe the world is controlled by an invisible intentional agent, confirmation bias, the seeking and finding of confirmatory evidence for what we already believe, and hindsight bias, tailoring after-the-fact explanations to what we already know happened. Now, it is the nature of the human experience to take in information and form opinions and beliefs based on theories, hypotheses, hunches, biases, and prejudices we've accumulated throughout our lifetime. We then sort through the body of data and select those most confirming of what we already believe, and ignore or rationalize away those that are disconfirming. In order to attempt to establish a hole-proof case, conspiracy theorists have quite some job of it. While the theory does tend to start with some sort of discrepancy, from that point the theorist has to explain everything that happened in a believable way. So they draw on their intelligence, some more successfully than others, to construct elaborate theories coloured by the factors Shermer outlines. In other words, smart people believe weird or dumb things because they are skilled at defending beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons. Admittedly, David Icke's theories are off-the-chain, no-holds-barred bonkers. But some conspiracies are at the more plausible end of the scale. When falsehoods are plausible, they can seep unquestioned into the unconscious. We all make mental shortcuts and seldom bother to check the veracity of what we are told. Further, the illusion of truth can kick in when we hear something more than once, i.e. the more you hear something, the more likely you are to believe it's true. These two factors go some way to explaining how and why conspiracy theories gain traction in the public psyche. A degenerate cousin of conspiracy theorists are denialists, who disturbingly deny events or phenomena such as the Holocaust, global warming, and the existence of HIV. Writing for New Scientist, Deborah McKenzie suggests the underlying thread is that, like conspiracy theorists, denialists often set themselves up as courageous underdogs fighting a corrupt elite engaged in a conspiracy to suppress the truth or foist a malicious lie on people. Denial finds its most fertile ground in areas where science must be taken on trust. For the average Joe Blow, the scientific claims about global warming and evolution are taken on trust due to an inability to understand the detail of evidence as non-scientists. However, this lack of qualification does not stop denialists themselves from using explanations that may be couched in sciencey language, but which in reality rests on anecdotal evidence. So how do we as skeptics respond to conspiracy theorists and denialists? Write them off as loose units and move on? There is danger in such dismissal. AIDS denial has killed an estimated 330,000 people in South Africa. Vaccine denial has given a new lease of life to killer diseases such as measles and polio. Climate change denial delays action to prevent global warming. Schumer suggests it's important to let these groups be heard, to examine their claims, because in science it is never possible to know the absolute truth, and we must always be on the alert for where our ideas need to change. He also suggests that skeptics and those in possession of the facts have a duty to stand up and deliver full-throated debunking, repeated, often, and everywhere. It's a call for skeptics far and wide to leap out of their armchairs and spread the word of reason and evidence-based science. I feel an anthem coming on. Go forth and be vocally skeptical, my friends. This has been Catherine reporting for the Badcast.
Birmingham Skeptics in the Pub exists to provide an opportunity for people who are interested in science, skepticism, rationalism, and critical thinking to socialize and discuss matters of interest. Each month we invite someone to come and speak to us, and if there's someone you'd like to hear, let us know. Find out more at www.skepticsinthepub.co.uk.
My name's Patrick Redmond, and I'm here for the Badcast, and I'm talking to Steve Fuller. Steve, hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
Okay, good. Steve, the Badcast deals a lot with science and a lot with religion, and you're a person who has a lot to say on both of those areas. So I thought I'd chat with you really and just see where you are on your views of the relationship between science and religion these days. Do you want to just give the listeners a bit of background about yourself?
Sure. I'm currently Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick, but I was originally trained in history and philosophy of science. One of the things that you learn in that field is that, in fact, religion, especially the Judeo-Christian and Islam, the Abrahamic religions, have been very strongly implicated in the development of science, and for a lot of reasons, one of the most important ones being that the sort of special relationship that human beings have to God as kind of privileged creatures, having been created in the image and likeness of God and all that kind of stuff, actually has served as a kind of motivator for humans to think that they can understand much more than just their immediate environment, but they can understand, you know, as it were, the whole universe, you know, get into the mind of God, as the physicists still talk about the matter. And so that's something that's been very much studied by historians and philosophers, and it's pretty well established. And the controversial issue, basically, is whether that kind of worldview imported from religion that enabled the scientific revolution, whether that's still relevant today. And that, it seems to me, is where you start to get all of the significant disagreements between science and religion that are going on now in our culture.
What is your position in the disagreements that are happening? Are you on the side of saying that science should still be very much related to the Judeo-Christian tradition and that is still a driving force?
Yeah. I think there's a real problem once you drop it completely. I mean, and I think that you know, this is the thing that I think atheists, especially very strong atheists of the kind of new atheist variety that we see with Richard Dawkins and people like that, I think this is an issue they really haven't faced squarely, because if you have a very strong Darwinian view of what a human being is. A human being is basically a genetic accident in the animal kingdom, and the way in which, you know, animals and other creatures survive, according to the evolutionary picture, is by having forms of knowledge and ways of behaving that are well adapted to the environments in which they normally find themselves. Now, it seems to me that if we were to think about knowledge in those terms, it seems to me that most of what we value most about science, for example, wouldn't fit, okay? Because science is the thing that gave us nuclear energy, nuclear power, spaceships to the moon, you know, Einstein and Newton trying to come up with universal laws of nature that apply to much more than Earth for 75 years. And so it seems to me that, you know, there's a kind of interesting question that evolutionists have to face, namely, why do we value so highly, why have we been so successful at this kind of science that, in a sense, takes us very far away from what is necessary to survive as animals on Earth with all the other animals?
The biological evolution, which, if you follow that, I do, that has led to us becoming the organisms that we are, and then our ideas and society have moved on, and we've made all these scientific discoveries, but then the application of them is a different thing altogether. I can't see how that fits in as a criticism on evolution.
Well, because we actually are quite willing to take quite a lot of risks, I think much greater risks than would be evolutionarily permissible, okay? I mean, we've all been exposed to an enormous amount of, nuclear energy, nuclear arms. I mean, the greater amount of knowledge that we have pursued, okay, put the species increasingly at risk. And I think the global warming issue is a great example of this, as it's happening now. And that's kind of interesting from an evolutionary standpoint. How did we get into that kind of situation? That would, that in a way, I would have thought from a Darwinian standpoint, science has made us incredibly maladaptive creatures.
No, well, I mean, we're incredibly well-adapted creatures, but we're progressing at a scientific level. And as we make the discoveries and as we make the inventions that we do, we have to find ways
of
implementing
them. And we keep on getting closer to destroying the planet. I'm being a strict Darwinian about this. I don't personally believe this line I'm telling you,
sure.
I'm saying if you're a real evolutionist, you would have a lot of doubts about the way science has developed.
I have doubts about I don't deny that there needs to be some kind of moral stance to science, or that science should be totally devoid of some kind of looking at what it does with the things that it does. But I don't see that in the sense of that we're evolving towards destroying ourselves, and therefore this denies the Darwinian
idea. So you're a global warming skeptic?
Am I a global warming skeptic? No, I'm not.
Yeah, you're a skeptic. Maybe you're a global warming skeptic too.
No.
The scientists have kind of over-egged this.
Well, I think that the most of the evidence that I've seen on global warming would point towards it being a human background to the current situation. Yeah, I would see.
Sure, exactly. But you think, but the point is, that most of the scientists saying that if we continue along the lines we've been continuing with regard to scientific and technological development applied to the planet, right, we are going to shift the temperature levels to such an extent that large numbers of people and other species on the planet are going to be seriously endangered within 50 years.
Yeah, and hopefully they're going to...
Do you believe that?
I believe that it's a possibility. I mean, I'm not a scientist in that area myself, so I would have to go through and trust other people to interpret that data for me. But I believe that it's something that needs to be looked at. But I don't see how that equates to we are evolving in a way that's going to destroy the Earth. That's something that's happened as a byproduct of what we're doing, and now we have to deal with that kind of a mess. But I don't see how...
Sure, we could just stop it, though. Couldn't we just stop it?
Yeah, but society is huge.
Kind of like...
because we're not a single organism, we are a whole diverse species with lots of different cultures and lots of different people and lots of different things at play that we have to work out now. It's not just one random mutation
sure.
that leads on to...
Here's the point I would make about this.
Okay.
The point I would make about this is the reason why we're reluctant to stop science and technology, there are all these risks, is because we actually believe that we're going to be able to figure out some kind of answer. That we're going to have some kind of way of getting around this. You know, in other words, these problems may have been caused by science and technology, but they'll also be solved by science and technology.
Okay.
And we'll come up with some clever way of doing this. Now, my question to you, do you believe that? It may be true, but the amount of self-confidence that this species has had over for at least the last 300 years, if not longer, to kind of do all these massive transformations of the planet. I mean, see, if you're a strict Darwinian, you wouldn't be putting yourself in these perilous situations all the time.
Sure, I mean, nobody, I mean...
You would be trying to adapt your environment.
I don't want to spend all the time talking about the climate, but the thing with the climate changes, we didn't set out to do that. That's something that has happened, and there's still the debate about what
we
could
stop it, couldn't we?
Yeah, if people could
agree. Just because we didn't intend it to happen, now that we see it, can't we stop it?
Yeah, possibly. Oh, and let me get a word in here. Okay, so back to the science. I understand what you're saying. I do know where you're coming from on this now. I'm not going to argue on the climate thing because I don't have all the background of it. I don't have all this stuff. My view is, and I'll finish on this, is that the overwhelming evidence to me is that there's a human background to the climate change, and we have to look at ways of stopping that. And some of that might be technological ways, and some of it might be social ways of doing it, but we do need to do that. But we're a big, diverse group of people with lots of different policies, politics, and interests at play that have now got to be worked out. We're not a single organism.
But you believe we'll be able to do it, right?
I'm hoping that we'll be able to do it, yeah. I mean, I'm fairly optimistic.
Yeah, and why do you believe that?
Oh, I'm an optimistic skeptic. There's not a lot of point.
No, but what does that mean, being an optimist? See, what does being an optimist mean if you're a Darwinist? Because, I mean, the writing's on the wall from an evolutionary standpoint. We're heading for destruction.
We're heading for destruction. Well, most species are at one point or another, aren't they? Something's going to wipe us out at some point, whether it's a huge asteroid out of the sky, global warming, or whatever. But hopefully it's not going to be global warming, and it's not going to be anytime soon. Back to science.
I agree with you, but I think that if you really take a Darwinian view on this, you know, a lot of the people who hold Darwinian views, in fact, are making the argument for greater environmental consciousness. They're the people who are saying we got to be concerned about the species being extinct. I mean, they're, in fact, among the people who are very strong on the global warming stuff and really want us to curtail our technological developments and so forth.
Okay. Okay, let's come off the global warming side, because...
Okay.
What is science to you? Because when I've been reading some of the things you've written recently in The Guardian, and some of the things when you were making... Because I don't know whether the listeners out there will know, you were very much involved in the intelligent design and a lot of the debate around the intelligent design. What do you see as actually science? What is your definition of what science is? Because I haven't been able to get a complete feel of what you define science to be.
Well, I mean, I actually identify science with what the history of Western science has been, at least since the Scientific Revolution, which is trying to come up with a rational, maximally comprehensive view of the world. And it is a world view. So I mean, if science presupposes the idea that there's a universe, and when I say a universe, I don't mean just reality, but that there's some kind of unity to the reality, and this is why we constantly are looking for laws of nature, and these laws of nature just don't apply to what's going on Earth, but potentially apply to everything that's going on, you know, in other galaxies, whatever, right? And physics has been the vanguard of that, you know, conception of science.
Okay.
And the rest of the history of science has kind of followed in the wake of that, and it's a very distinctive project, okay? It is logical, it's mathematical, and it's empirical, but it also has this sense of progress, and it has this kind of, kind of trajectory to get a more unified, more comprehensive understanding of reality. So, you know, Newton, Einstein, all these people, these are scientists. I mean, in that respect, my definition of science is not so strange.
No.
Okay? It is historically that conception of science.
You argued in a piece that I read recently that some of the alternative sciences that are coming out, some of the New Age scientists, some of the humanist scientists, were akin to the Protestant Reformation, in a sense, the different religious groups are coming out, and that they're not anti-science.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that maybe your listeners don't know, I mean, was that before Protestantism... When we talk about Protestantism, right, we mean this movement that began in the 16th century, where you start to get multiple forms of dissent from the Church of Rome, which at that point, you know, the Catholic Church was the one authoritative body for Christianity, at least in the West, not the East, of course, sure, but in the West. Um, and And so Protestantism basically is this kind of fragmentation of authority that takes place, and you have all these Protestant denominations, you know, many of which still exist and are flourishing. And the thing that was very important that enabled the Protestant Reformation to happen was the printing press.
Okay.
And the printing press is very important because it's only when you start to be able to manufacture Bibles in a way that people can buy and can use, and that they're actually produced in the languages that the people speak. Because, see, up to before the time of the printing press, Bibles were these handcrafted things that were in Latin, which nobody spoke. And the Catholic Church itself was not stressing that believers had to read the Bible.
Yeah.
Right? What the Catholic Church wanted you to do was to believe in what the priests and the Pope said and all that, but they weren't telling you to read the Bible for yourself and make your own decisions. That is something that Protestantism introduced, okay? And this is where, you know, all of this Bible business that nowadays, you know, a lot of people don't like comes from Protestantism. Basically, what the Protestants did was to take Christianity into their own hands quite literally by learning to read the Bible and then drawing their own conclusions about what it says. And those conclusions led them to disagree with what the people in Rome were saying. Now, what we have today that's analogous to that is the fact that with the Internet, with increasing amount of education in science, even if it's not perfect, but nevertheless, people are finding out more about science through taking courses, through reading stuff in magazines, newspapers, watching television shows. I mean, there's never before has there been so much information out there about science.
Sure.
People, just like the Protestants, are drawing their own conclusions about what to believe and what not to believe. And generally, these people do not disbelieve everything. It's not like these people are anti-science in that sense, but rather they have a kind of pick-and-mix attitude, you might say. And so a lot of, like, New Age stuff, if you look at the New Age stuff closely, first of all, the people who do it tend to be pretty well-educated, even well-to-do people.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they and what they have is kind of a from a kind of traditional scientific standpoint, they've got a kind of hybrid view of things where they mix some stuff they pick up from some religion with some fairly standard stuff from science, and they blend it together in their own way.
So in this analogy, then, would you say that the Church of Rome is represented in the analogy by the ordinary methodological kind of standard traditional view of science is represented by Dawkins and those kinds of figures?
Yeah, the Royal Society, the National Academies of Science, you know, whenever scientists make authoritative pronouncements, right, telling us what is and is not science. I mean, so for example, with the evolution, creation, intelligent design controversy in the United States, I mean, where it's really been very big, you actually do get very official statements made by the National Academy of Science in the United States telling everybody creationism and intelligent design is not science. Okay? I mean, that's very much like a papal edict.
And do you believe, right, that creationism and intelligent design is science? Is that the same kind of thing?
Sure. See, the key thing is not the belief. The key thing isn't the belief, it's how you exactly go about studying and testing it.
Okay.
Okay? So for example, take young earth creationism. Take a very extreme case.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, so you got these young earth creationists out there, and these guys believe that the world was created in 6 days, okay? And they believe also that the age of the earth is about 6,000 years old, based on biblical genealogy.
Sure.
Okay. Now, is this science? Well, I think the key thing to look at is what are these people doing? Now, if all they're doing is telling you read the Bible, the answers are already there, end of story, then of course that's not science.
Okay.
But a lot of these people are doing something else, okay? A lot of these people actually study geology, and they're actually trying, you know, successfully or not, time will tell, they're actually trying to question the methods on which rocks and fossils are dated.
Isn't the problem from this, though, that they're taking the conclusion from the Bible that this is what it is, and then the science that they're doing is directly straight towards finding the evidence for the conclusion that they've already got, regardless of any amount of evidence or the contrary anyway, which, to my mind,
would
be science.
They do that. Yeah, they do that too. Yes, they do that too. But they're also trying to question the methods of the people who disagree with them, which is scientific.
Okay, yeah, I mean, the whole point of science is that you put the process up for questioning and you have peer review. Sure, go on.
You know, look, I talk to these people. There are a lot of these people who actually have degrees in geology and stuff like that. It's not that these people are idiots. These people actually do have degrees in other scientific subjects, and they've studied the stuff they actually actively disagree with.
I mean, I've never confused intelligence with being rational. I don't think the two have to go together. I know lots of intelligent people.
No, but I do think that's an important point for your listeners to know, because there is a tendency to stereotype this debate to make it look as though that, like, the young earth creationists, who are certainly the most extreme versions of this whole controversy, you know, people, it's easy for people to get the impression that everyone who's a young creationist, you know, basically reads the Bible as a science textbook, and that's the only textbook they need.
But I think the problem...
I actually think that there are...
Problem for a lot of the people who would listen to this, who have an interest in science with the young earth creationists, is that from the biological, the geological, the astronomical, there's so many pointers and such a huge overwhelming body of evidence that goes against 6,000 years, that to continue in the face of that, despite all that, is just, to some degree, seems ludicrous, to be honest.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, I think this issue, you know, if you want to, the way I look at this, to be honest, how many resources are being expended on this? Okay? I mean, it's not like the young earth creationists are trying to shut down the ordinary forms of biology to replace them with what they're doing. At least I haven't seen that go on yet. Maybe you know something I don't know, but they're not doing that. They're just looking for some space to do their own work, which is not very cost intensive. Okay? And I do believe, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you want to have this stuff judged by whether it's published in peer-reviewed journals, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not disagreeing with any of that. But it does seem to me that if you look at the history of science, it is not impossible, and it's certainly, you know, not only it's not impossible, there's a certain degree of probability that even, you know, fundamental methods by which we evaluate things in science will be shown to have flaws over time. I mean, really, there's no reason for us to believe that the more we study cosmology or geology or whatever, that we are necessarily going to end up finding that the Earth or the universe is just getting older and older and older. It may be at some point we find that we have, you know, our methods are flawed and that we might have to knock a few zeros off the age. And I wouldn't be surprised that if that happened, some of these young Earth creationists will have been involved.
Sure, well, I...
Because they're motivated. They're motivated to find those flaws.
Yeah, I mean, they're motivated to find evidence for their presupposed beliefs that they've got from the Bible.
No, they're also motivated to find evidence that goes against the other side, and that's the key point. That's the key point for the science.
Sure, and I think right? I think that scientists and the mainstream body of science as well aren't just looking to verify the theories that are already out there, but are looking to make names for themselves and to find discoveries and to further the research. And if they come across a bit of research themselves or a bit of evidence that's going to change our perception of the universe, knock a few noughts off, put a few noughts on, that will come from the main methodological body of science just as much.
Well, I mean, but this is okay. Well, look, see, this is where I think this is not quite true. I mean, I actually think there's very little incentive within normal scientific establishment to actually do what you're talking about, okay? And I think that's one of the problems that in a way doesn't quite get the attention that it deserves. I mean, yes, there is a lot of motivation in science to come up with things that will overturn certain kinds of views.
Okay.
That's true. But I think when we're talking about very fundamental things like the age of the universe or the age of the Earth, right, which is a very fundamental thing, as you were pointing out, a lot of stuff depends on it. And given the cultural significance of this, right, the fact that, you know, if you were to knock off these zeros, that it would really change things a lot, I don't think there's really a lot of incentive within the normal scientific community to even touch this issue. Okay, I don't think anyone really wants to touch this issue.
I mean, If that was the case, I'd be very disappointed, because my view of science is that it's progress. You look at the evidence, and if that's what the evidence is telling you, you put it forward. I mean, your analogy
to it's not just evidence. Look, evidence is in a way kind of a red herring here.
Okay.
It's the issues that you consider important to look at. Okay, when we talk about there being a scientific research frontier, right, we think science is going in a certain direction. What that means, one of the things that means is that scientists are focusing their attention on certain things that they think are important to find out about. And I can tell you right now, I don't think there are many scientists being focused on whether, you know, the Earth might end up being only a few thousand years old rather than a few millions or billions of years old.
But is that,
and I don't think there's a lot of action on that front, okay?
But is that because the evidence is so overwhelming at one point that by putting funding towards that kind of area where other areas could be better funding, that's research that in some way doesn't need to be done to that kind of degree? I'm not really sure what the point is on that.
Well,
I mean, if they feel that it's...
Well, the point is, you don't spend a lot of money on something that is very, you know, extreme and improbable. I agree with you. You don't spend a lot of money on it.
I'm saying that without having the figures in front of me as to how much money is being spent on research in different bits, I couldn't really give you an answer to how much is being done.
No, but I mean, the point here is that, look, there is young Earth creationists trying to do this kind of stuff on their own, to be, you know, and I don't think it's actually a very expensive kind of research project, to be honest with you, because what we're talking about is basically checking the reliability of the methods that are used for dating the Earth, okay, and that's not like sending a rocket to the moon or anything like that. I mean, just because it had very, very substantial implications, if it turns out that we're dating things wrong, doesn't mean it costs a lot of money to do research on it.
Sure. I think.
Okay. So it's actually, I think, a fairly. Go ahead.
I think where a lot of people would have a problem is where, say, with the intelligent design debate, having intelligent design included in the textbooks alongside evolution, when intelligent design wouldn't really be considered science. I know you consider it science, possibly, but it wouldn't be considered science in the same way as evolutionists. And In the other analogy of the methodological sciences, the Catholic Church, and all these internet-based and doing-it-yourself at-home eclectic scientific groups, which you've termed as prot science, which a lot of people that I know would term those as being pseudoscience, because with science you shouldn't just be choosing what you believe. You should be looking at the evidence and weighing it up and making some kind of rational view. But the kind of prot science that you're talking about doesn't seem to have that kind of rationality. Any collection of beliefs or views...
Of course it does. Of course. Look, because people... You see, this is the thing you don't get is that the people who do this prot science take science very seriously. So they believe... And so seriously, they believe that it applies to their life. In other words, they want to be living a scientific life.
Okay.
That's what they want to do. They don't see science as just, as it were, trying to get it right in some sort of abstract sense. Okay, so science isn't like a job, as it were, that you sort of do a 9-to-5 thing in the lab and then you go home and you're somebody else. No, these people want a very integrated view, right? They want science integrated in their lives. They want to live scientific lives. And what that means then is that they have to draw their own conclusions about what it is that various scientists are saying about things. And they're doing it as rationally as they can. But part of what's going on when they think about this stuff is that they take their own personal experience probably much more seriously. They give it much more evidential weight than I think an ordinary scientist would.
Okay.
Right? I mean, I think that's certainly the case with something like the holistic medicine.
Sure, but I mean the big thing there would be that experience and anecdote would not be counted as evidence and data necessarily for in a clinical setting or in a normal science setting. You're talking about people having their beliefs about science, if you like, whereas that's not the same as having a scientific view. just believing that something is scientific, and anybody is entitled to their belief, but as it, the old saying that people aren't entitled to their own facts, and at some point in science there's got to be some leaning towards the body of evidence says this, so until something better comes along, that's what's going to be the actual fact, whereas not just, well, this fits much more into my personal experience, so therefore I'm going to believe it, which is much more kind of a supernatural or pseudo-scientific point of view.
No, the problem is these people know the limitations of experiments and clinical trials. They know that these things, while they're very highly valued within the scientific community, they do not generalize necessarily well across all the cases to which they have to be applied. Okay, this is especially true in the case of medicine, where people are quite willing to take the risks themselves and say, yeah, these experiments say one thing, but, you know, the experiments work well in the laboratory setting under the controlled conditions, but we're talking about real life here, okay? And in real life, things are always a little bit different because there are always complicating factors. And I think people know that, right? I mean, again, these are not people who are ignorant of the scientific method. They know the scientific method, but one thing they know is it has limitations. It has limitations, especially when we talk about things like medicine, where at the end of the day, it's going to be applied to particular people. And I think that, I don't think that's pseudoscience at all. I think that's actually reflecting a calculated risk that people are willing to take. People are willing to say, I am going to go against what these scientists say, not because I don't understand what they say, not because I don't, believe a gun, but rather because I think that there is enough of an uncertainty about how that I'm going to take the risk in my own case.
Okay. I mean, there's...
That's the way I think these people...
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not saying, like, I don't believe that the people who practice alternative medicine and so forth are necessarily unintelligent people, and I don't think that they don't understand the scientific principle necessarily, but I don't think that perhaps they value the scientific principle as much as could be, and the complications and the extra things in life that are outside the thing can still be explained. Just because they don't accept those explanations don't mean that those things aren't real. And I think that having alternative medicine, complementary therapies or whatever you want to term them, has implications on other areas. But by the by, whatever your arguments for against belief, whether it's a placebo, it's still this idea that it's a science that is the same as another science, as the main evidence-based methodological
science. Well, that's the thing. I guess I'm wondering, where does your concern come? What are you worried about? What exactly are you worried about here?
I'm not worried, really. I think what I was looking at when I was trying to read through, and I've listened to a couple of your lectures and so forth, is to try and gain an understanding of what it is that you meant by science, because I kind of know what I mean by science. But a lot of the times when I'm listening to you and reading you, what you're talking about very often doesn't seem like science to me. It seems to be more based upon belief and personal experience. Whereas, I mean, you would perhaps just classify me as being part of the traditional archetypal authoritative view of bought into that kind of natural science dogma, if you like. Whereas you're not dogmatic.
Well, the problem is science is more than just a method at the end of the day. Science is the most authoritative form of knowledge in our society, okay? And it's supposed to be knowledge that applies to everything and everyone, okay?
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me that these plot science people believe that. They take that seriously, which means it's got to apply to them too. It can't be some other thing. It can't be some, it can't be like the Pope telling people what the truth is that they have no connection to. That can't be what science is.
Sure, but there's got to be limits.
That's kind of what you sound like.
I mean, there's got to be some limits, hasn't there? I mean, you can't choose suddenly
go back to the question. What are you worried about? What are you worried about exactly?
I'm not worried. It's not that I'm worried. I'm interested.
At the end of the day, what is it that you're supposed to... to disobey what their GP says,
okay,
and just go off and do all kinds of complementary holistic medicine,
whatever.
Would they be doing this for their children?
What's
the problem?
I mean, are they choosing for their children that their children aren't going to be
inoculated?
Are they going to be choosing that their children shouldn't have antibiotics when they've got illnesses?
Well, let's say, yeah, okay, that's a very timely issue. Okay.
You know, I mean, if you're making a personal decision for yourself to place you in harm, then perhaps that's up to them. But if you're making it that could put society or children or people that don't have that kind of right to make a choice at home, then that's a different kind of an issue. But I mean,
but the point is, somebody makes these choices, whatever happens.
Somebody does.
What if the scientists get it wrong and they're making the choices on behalf of the children?
Yeah, but
I mean, I'm not sure what I mean. This is going to be a problem no matter what.
Mm-hmm. When the scientists get you wrong, though, the scientists. But hopefully the scientists before the medicine is at the shelves has had to go through a whole stringent testing routine involving placebos and clinical trials and all of the kinds of things that have tried to make sure that this is
sure exactly. But that's even then, you know, I mean, given the fact that the kids, but then when you actually apply to particular kids in particular places, given whatever other things are going on in the kids' environment and whatever else they're eating or taking or whatever, there could be all kinds of adverse effects the scientists won't be able to anticipate.
Sure.
I mean, the point is you can get a hit either way.
Yeah.
I mean, and the question is whether you live.
No, go on.
Can you live with the risk? I mean, the point here is, you know, there's going to be a risk no matter who does it. I mean, if supposing the scientists, with all their wonderful clinical, put a certain, medicine out there, which everybody believes because it's scientifically authorized, but the scientists hadn't realized that these people are also doing lots of other things in their lives that actually go against the effect of the medicine, and these people get even more seriously ill. Whose fault is that? I mean, is it the scientist's fault? Is it the parents' fault? I don't know. It's just normal risk, it seems to me.
Well, when I go to the doctors and the
you
doctor
can't control
gives me,
for everything.
When I go to the doctors and the doctor gives me my prescription, I pick it up. There's a sheet in there which says, you know, there may be some risks involved in taking this, and you should try and avoid doing this. And they try and do the best that they can for most circumstances that you could possibly foresee, and that's about as good as you can be. So yeah, there's no way that you can get rid of every single element of risk in life with everything, but it's something that's been tested and it's something that's been controlled. I mean, this is gone by the by, but off the subject that we're talking with alternative medicine and camp. There's other things that's happening there. People feel that they feel better, but the reasons aren't necessarily going to be because of anything that they're actually taking. There's other things that are happening within the environment.
Yeah, but they're also,
go on.
No, but look, but they are also told, they're also told exactly the kind of thing you just said. The people who do the alternative medicine stuff also tell their patients exactly this business of do not do this, do not do that, right? They go through the list of conditions, also trying to anticipate possible effects and so forth. So, I mean, it's not just the orthodox practitioners who do that. Also, the alternative guys do that, too, because they, you know, I mean, so, it's not like these alternative guys just kind of do something strange and then tell the people just to go out and do whatever they want.
Not sure, but,
it's all about a lifestyle thing.
I mean,
if anything, the alternative medicine people are...
In some cases, like homeopathy, there's no need to actually tell people not to worry about doing things because there's no actual active chemical agent within the homeopathic thing. And in those kind of circumstances, any benefit that's felt tends to be about the fact that the person talking to them gets 40 or 50 minutes telling them that this is going to make them feel better and they should not doing this. And there's a whole load of other effects that are going on in there. I mean, there's no actual chemical involved in most homeopathic or any homeopathic treatments beyond a certain point.
That may be true, but if the person ends up being better and lives a better life as a result, I'm not sure that's...
But the point I would make
is... I'm quite willing to go...
That's not what most people would term science, and that's not what I would personally call science. It's not that I'm worried about anything. I mean, you kept asking me earlier what I was worried about. It isn't that I'm worried.
Look, the placebo effect is gradually being incorporated into makes medicine work. The placebo effect happens everywhere.
It does, yeah, although there's some controversy over what the placebo effect
is. But there's nothing. The placebo effect by itself is not damning. Okay, the placebo effect is just another causal factor that operates in the healing process, not only with alternative medicine, but also to a certain extent with orthodox medicine as well.
I mean, the placebo effect, I mean, there's this controversy over what actually the
placebo
effect is.
It's not like you eliminate the placebo effect.
Some people say the placebo effect doesn't actually heal. It might change people's perceptions of what there is, but if you've got an actual infection, there's no amount of placebo that's going to get rid of that infection or cure your cancer or cure your AIDS. There's no placebo that could do that.
Well, actually, it's kind of a little bit of controversy. There's some evidence that, in fact, people change psychological states, emit various chemicals that end up boosting the immune system. It'll happen. And if you give a very kind of holistic understanding of what is happening to the entire body when people are believing this stuff, what it does to their brains and how that ends up feeding into their hormones, I mean, you know, and their immune system or whatever, I mean, then there could be substantial effect. Or at least this is a very open question.
Yeah.
It's not crazy. I
think there needs to be more studies on those things and more evidence going around, perhaps, in terms of what the placebo effect is. But in terms of a lot of alternative medicine, there's been lots and lots and lots of studies and things done. But let's not, I mean, I didn't get you on here to debate alternative medicine. I mean, from a personal level, it wasn't a worry, but what I was trying to understand, just because I quite enjoy arguments and I quite enjoy debate, and I've listened to you in a few debates and a few arguments, was to just get some kind of an idea of what it is, because to me, sometimes it just sounds like the argument is about you're saying that this science is as good as this science, and I just think to some degree that they're two different things that you're arguing, that the one is what most people would call science and would be society's definition of science, and what you consider, what you think should be classified in the same field and have the same kind of status, is something that's very different. You know, I don't think the analogy.
No, I would say you have a very narrow conception of science. You think science is just a yardstick approach, just kind of a method. You know, you go in the lab, see if it works, etc. Whereas I think that science is actually that plus more. Namely, it's something that has the kind of authority that it has in society as the most significant form of knowledge. And in a way, it's kind of very much defining the form of knowledge that defines us as human beings is science. Okay? So I take it very seriously. But what that means then is that people have to be able to live scientific lives. They have to be able to relate to science. And it seems to me that science has kind of done a disservice if it's just reduced to what happens in labs and what happens when you measure things, and then you end up, you know, with the conclusion that most people, no matter how interested they are in science, don't know anything about it.
Sure.
Which is kind of what I think a lot of scientists believe these days.
I mean, I'm
and that's crazy.
I'm very involved with the skeptics in the pub and the skeptics movement. Things and I'm a great believer in grassroots science and people. I mean, I don't have a scientific background, but I'm a great believer that people who are interested in science should be able to get out there, read things, find out things. But then just eclectically taking the stuff that you want to believe in isn't actually doing science. And if people want to know about science, then they should be looking at what the scientific process is and having some kind of idea of what science is, and not just being able to have anything that they define as being science as doing science, because that's not necessarily interest in science, fantastic. Get out there and read all the stuff, absolutely brilliant. But then learn some tools for evaluating and criticizing the things that you're reading and being able to put weight to different arguments and not just accepting it.
Yeah, but they do that. This is the point. They do that. They just don't reach the same conclusion.
Okay.
They are doing that. Okay, the intelligent design movement illustrates very well the point that you're making about this business of people actually evaluating the scientific evidence and so forth for themselves. It's just they end up reaching different conclusions. And in fact, one of the things that's probably what people who know about intelligent design at all listening to this, well, it is actually criticisms of the Darwinian paradigm, of modern evolutionary theory. And the criticisms themselves are not wrong. It's just what, you know, the argument is it doesn't necessarily support intelligent design, but that there are these problems with the Darwinian view of evolution. And see, that is quite typical of a lot of what I've been calling prop science. They're not denying the scientific method. They're not just believing what they want. They're actually looking at the scientific method, and they realize that the dominant scientific views have problems, even examined scientifically. And what that means is they see this as opportunities. Okay, so it's not born out of some ignorance or reluctance to deal with science. It is the fact that they do look at it, and they realize that certain things just don't hang together. And so they then propose alternatives. But I agree with you in one sense, namely, at the end of the day, these things have to stand or by whether they count, you know, whether they can meet the standards of science. So I agree with that. It's just that the dominant theories, that's right, they're not a sealed type. They're you know, they're not as unassailable as I think the defenders would suggest, right? That there is room for doubt, there is room for criticism, of the dominant scientific theory, and I think that's something that you find quite characteristic of all of these prod science people. That they're not just believing whatever they want. I mean, they're also criticizing the dominant scientific authorities.
Okay, I kind of think we've come full circle round, really. And I mean, I think that science is there to be questioned, and the theories are there to be questioned, but that the people who are questioning them should be doing so within a certain kind of scientific framework.
Oh, I agree, but I think that in a sense, if you really want to get everybody involved in the scientific enterprise, you have to move more and more in that direction. I mean, so you just have to get better at doing that kind of thing. You have to be able to kind of pick up on the different variables that are involved that might be influencing outcomes and things like that. But I think at the end of the day, that's kind of where we need to be, in that kind of direction of a kind of social experimentation in science. You know, so I agree it's difficult, and I agree, you know, but at the moment we've got very restricted notions of experimentation. Right, where in a sense things are just working under ideal conditions.
Okay, well, I think what you call ideal conditions, some people would call control conditions.
Well, yeah, exactly, but there's such a big difference between the control and what actually happens on the ground that you know, this is why I think people have all this skepticism about the applicability of the traditional scientific method.
Okay, I mean, I think that you and I both do agree that science shouldn't necessarily just be out there in the hands of the elite, and that a greater scientific knowledge, yeah, and interest amongst the wider population is something that's desirable. I think that's one area that we can at least agree on.
And
I mean, you're very good at taking the debate out there, and that I mean, there's quite a lot of stuff out there where you're debating, you have some people who agree with you, and then you have a lot of people from the traditional science standards who disagree with you. But you're never shy to turn down a good debate or argument, from what I can see.
Yeah, it's probably true. Yeah.
We'll wrap up there, Steve, because the sound quality just picked up again. But if we just summarize, the reason I wanted to talk to you was to just find out what your views of science were, and to see, I was intrigued at this idea of prot science, as to whether prot science, to my mind, equaled pseudoscience. And I'm personally, by my own definitions of what probably constitutes good science and pseudoscience, I would say that I still think that prot science possibly equates to pseudoscience, but I think you would perhaps say that was because of my limited definition. Would that be right?
I would say yes, and I think this issue might look a little differently 20, 30 years from now, okay, actually. Because the Protestants themselves were originally called atheists, you know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I can say that point. Well, maybe we should make a date in 20, 30 years from now. We'll meet up again.
Yeah, yeah.
See you again. I'll put it in my diary. Steve, thank you.
Alrighty.
Thank you very much for joining me.
you have been listening to the Badcast. To contact us, or to listen to past episodes, you can check out the website at www.badcast.co.uk. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.